40 doesn't work always, but it does help. So, you know, this happens to be the Lent season, right? All of us know that. And I've been, of course, speaking on the topic of servant leadership over whenever I get an opportunity here. So I was wondering, how do I mix this, you know, the servant leadership and an appropriate message for the Lenten season? And that's where I came across this topic called healing, right? And so healing is one of the servant leadership characteristics that that we talk about. I'm sure most of us must have seen this a couple of times before. You know, these are the 10 attributes, what is there inside here, and these are the 7 behavioral patterns, as I call it, of servant leadership, right? And over the past few sessions, I have covered a few of them. I have covered community, I have covered conceptualization, and a few of them. And today, I will cover what we call as the servant leadership characteristic of healing. So, I'm of course not talking about miracle healing. I'm talking about emotional healing. Okay? It's not the other miracle healing that I'm talking about. I have no plans to upstage Benihin, right? And the like. So I'm going to talk about emotional healing, and you know, basically, you know, a servant leader's ability to heal oneself and others. You know, it's not only about healing others, but it's also emotionally able to heal ourselves. Learning to heal is really a powerful force of transformation. Learning to heal is a powerful force of transformation and integration. You know, if you want to be a servant leader, one of the things that we must learn, one of the great strengths of servant leadership, is the ability to identify who is a wounded person, what is the cause of the wound, what is the root cause of the wound, and then be able to lead that person to a state of healing. That's really the need or the call of servant leadership. Robert Greenleaf, the author of the book called Servant as Leader, he says this, I quote, "There is something subtle communicated to one who is being served and led if implicit in the compact between the servant leader and the led is the understanding that the search for wholeness is something that they have in common." So for both the person who is leading as well as the person who is being led, the search for wholeness, the search for healing, the search for, you know, moving away from the brokenness or completing that or bridging that brokenness is a necessity. And I'm sure we know this. We live in a world full of wounded people, right? I'm sure all of us must have gone through a wounded experience in our lives at some time or the other. Brother Jordan Island is sitting with a physical wound right now, so he can relate with it, you know, a lot better. But other than the physical wound, I'm sure all of us must have gone through an emotional wounded you know, season in our lives, whether it is caused by ourselves or by others, you know. So that one time when we wish that, you know, someone would apply that healing touch on us. So servant leaders emerge when they are able to identify those people, when they are able to reach out to those people, when they are able to touch those people, when they are able to really bring out the issue that is really troubling them and lead them to a place of healing. So let's try to look at, you know, what causes the wounds. What causes typically the wounds that, you know, that one has. And I'm sure there are multiple things. The main causes of wounding is, first and foremost, is ourselves. The causes that we cause ourselves. What we have done. What we have gotten involved in. It could be some things that we did, some things that we said. You know, it could be our actions, our thoughts, the sin that we commit, and things like that. So basically, things which are caused by ourselves, right? And the next one is wounds others cause to you. This is in abusive relationships. It could be, you know, enmity from someone else or whatever. You know, it could be cruelty, it could be pure malice, whatever else it is, the others that cause to you. And then, of course, life is not very simple. There are so many things that happen around us, you know, wounds caused in the life by things that is not in our control really. By accidents, by disability, by sickness, by loss, by, you know, natural disasters like the tsunami that's happened in Japan. So many things which happen around us where we have no control over, but it does impact, you know, us and it causes wounds for us. And the last one is, of course, so next one is by generational sins, you know. So this is where, you know, we look at what our parents did, what was the life that they have, or our forefathers, you know. So sort of things which get passed on, things which are typically what is called as the chain of ungrace, you know, which gets passed on from generation to generation. And of course, the last one is our dear friend, the evil one. You know, he is obviously there, darting arrows at us at any point in time. So the spiritual warfare that is on, and the way the evil one, you know, attacks us, especially Christians, especially those who believe in Jesus Christ. He doesn't want, you know, to leave them free. So these are, of course, you could add to this list. I'm sure each one of you could identify, you know, something that has wounded you and something that might fall in this category, or maybe outside of this category. You know, there are many other things. You know, I was listening to a class by Dr. Steve Brown. He is a professor at the Reformed Theological Seminary. Nowadays, you know, the seminaries have become online. So the RTS is an online course called Grace in Church. And Dr. Steve Brown, he talks on this grace in the church. And he talks about as many as 12 prisons that Christians put ourselves into. It's interesting to take a look at these prisons. And maybe as you look through this list, I'd encourage you to try and identify which prison we are in, right? I can identify myself in many of them, I tell you, right? I'm sure each of you would be able to identify yourself in at least one of them, right? Otherwise, of course, you should be an angel. So, well, I'm not. So, I'm definitely there in many of those lists. The first is prisons of what we do. Okay? This is again, by our own action. Prison of sin. I mean, this is something which is common. We have sinned, and you know, what happens is we continue to live on that, on the feeling of that guilt and of that sin, you know? So what happens is at some point in time we start believing, we start saying to ourselves, Christians are good, okay, quote unquote, Christians are good, I am not good because I have sinned, and so I am not good to be a Christian. See the connection? So we end up into that type of situation where we say that, look, I have sinned, so I am not good enough to be a Christian, right? And then it goes on. But the fact is, let me state this. The fact is, everybody here has a secret that you haven't told anyone. And if you tell that secret to everybody else in this room or in this church, two things could happen. One is, you could be out of here. Two is, you could be suicidal. Everybody has got a secret. Everybody has got a dark secret that we haven't yet shared with someone. And if we tell that to everyone else, we could either be out of here or we could be suicidal. That's the power of sin. You know, that's the evil hole that sin can have. And if we don't deal with it properly, we'll come to how do we deal with it properly. But if we don't deal with it properly, what could happen is we could get imprisoned in the prison of sin. The second one is, of course, the prison of guilt. We do something wrong, we get punished for it, and it's over with. That's typically the, you know, especially children. You know, if Abigail goes and dirties a new cloth, a new dress that, you know, Patrick purchased for her, Ebony is going to probably get angry, give her a whack on her bottom, and it's finished, okay? So the guilt is there, the punishment is there and it's over with, right? But others, we are not like that. Sometimes that guilt feeling remains with us, even after, you know, after all that is done. And I have seen and I have heard about Christians who feel guilty for something that happens, you know, which is outside of all, totally outside of their control. You know, to give an extreme example, I'm sure there are Christians in this world who feel guilty about the tsunami in Japan. Who feel guilty that the tsunami in Japan happened because of something that they did or perhaps they didn't do. You know, things like, okay, I didn't pray enough, or I didn't work enough to, you know, quick enough to reach the gospel to the people there. Whatever it is, there are people who can cook up a lot of things and feel guilty about it, you know. You can feel guilty about the famine and the poverty in Ethiopia, right? You don't know what all we can feel guilty about. So we have this knack of digging up guilt and putting it on ourselves sometime, and then putting it ourselves in a prison of guilt. The third is prison of failure, right? What if it doesn't work? What if it doesn't, you know, what if I fail, right? Am I good enough for my God? Am I good enough for my God? Is, you know, can I measure up to the high standards that are set by my God? That's the question which haunts us when we put ourselves into the prison of failure. Is it making sense? Or is it over us? Yeah? Okay, so let me go through the others a little quickly. Prisons of what we think. So the first one was prisons of what we do. The second one is prisons of what we think. Here is the prison of the past. Our childhood memories. What happened in the past. Our relationship and things like that. And then we get, you know, we get locked up in those. We are not able to get out of those. Prison of self-abasement. I'm not worthy. I'm a worm. You know, I'm nothing. Right? And sometimes actually, you know, there are preachers who drill this down so much into our mind that we really feel like a worm. Right? So this is something which comes up. You know, I'm not saying that we've got to be boastful and things like that, but then the other extreme is where we start treating ourselves as nothing. We start treating ourselves as dirt. We start treating ourselves as worms. We have absolutely no self-respect. You know, so all of us are somewhere in that continuum, okay, where we believe we are God's gift to mankind on one end, or the other end where we believe we are nothing and we are simply a worm which needs to be trampled upon, right? So which end of the spectrum are we in is one thing. That the third is, of course, prison of perfection. A lot of us know this. You know, everything has to be perfect, right? I serve a perfect God, so whatever I do needs to be perfect. And so then, you know, what happens with this is the sense of inadequacy sets in. We start feeling that we are not adequate. We are not good enough. You know, so that feeling comes in if we start, you know, falling into this prison. The third set is what we call, I mean, this is our relationship with others, right? How we relate to others. Prison of fear, right? Fear of rejection, fear of disapproval, fear of many other things, you know. What will happen if I do something? Will I be... And then the second one is the prison of approval. Will I be approved? What I do, will it be accepted by others? What will they think if I say something, if I do something? Will it gain approval from my peers, my wife, my spouse, my parents, my church members? Right? Will it get approval from those categories? And then, of course, it's the last one is the prison of obligation. You know, there somebody has done something to me, I'm obliged to do something back. You know, I'm obliged to do something back. How much can we stress this to? And then we start feeling obliged to do many things to many people. And then we start realizing we can't do everything. And then we start feeling guilty. And then we get into the prison of guilt. You know? So that's the cycle that goes on. And the last is, of course, very dangerous. Others control us. Or we let others control us. Okay? This is the prison of rules. I'm sure it's self-explanatory, right? People set rules. There's some do's and don'ts and you know, and things like that. If you are a Christian, you got to do certain things. You can't do certain things, right? you can't come to church wearing jeans and t-shirt or whatever, you know, the rules and regulations that are around us, not only in the religion, but the I didn't mean it. So, and then there is the person of religion. This is, of course, we know the rituals associated with religion, the need for us to, you know, observe certain rituals in spite of whether we believe in it or not, right? We feel, some of us feel start feeling guilty if we have to eat chicken biryani during a Lent season, right? It is Lent season. How can we eat non-veg, right? So these are sometimes the religious rules. Of course, some people follow it very well and it is good, but then some people follow it as a religion, and that's where the issue starts coming. And of course, the last one is the person of gurus. Gurus are, what gurus are, our heroes and heroines, right, whom we follow, right, whether it is, Paul Winogrand or whatever, you know, or Benny Hinn for that matter, or, so we start, instead of following Jesus Christ and his teachings, we start following certain gurus and end up there with them. So, and then we put ourselves into a prison, and we start going into what teachings these people give us rather than the teachings given in the Bible through the Word of God. Now we start diluting, or we start interpreting the Bible through the eyes of those gurus. And that becomes dangerous, right? So these are the 12 prisons that one can put ourselves into. Do we see ourselves in any of those? Okay, all right. I won't embarrass you by asking you to watch it. But like I said, I can definitely see myself into many of these prisons. We get into many of these prisons. So the question is, okay, we know what wounds is. We know what are the prisons. Now the question is, sure. So how do we get out of it? How do we heal? How do we reach that stage where we start talking about healing or releasing from the prisons that we are in, right? So that's the next question. So in my, some of the studies that I have done, two things come up. Of course, there could be multiple things, and in your own knowledge, you could add a lot more to it. But there are two key things that come up. The first one is this concept of forgiveness, right? The ability to forgive oneself and others in relationships, right? Now, this is very, very easily said. The ability to let go of the guilt, the fear, the hatred, the anger that we hold against somebody else or against ourselves, right? It's like I said, healing and forgiveness is a lot talked about, a lot written about. How much of it is really practiced in our lives? That's the question that I think we need to ask during this Lent season. How much of forgiveness do we really practice? Do we really practice? Charles Spurgeon, who Charles Spurgeon is, he says this, I quote, "The most outstanding mark of a Christian is his willingness to forgive those who have hurt or injured him." The most outstanding feature of a Christian is the willingness, not the ability, is the willingness to forgive those who have hurt or injured him. Research has been done on why do people come to church, join a church, or try to understand what Christianity is and then fall away. And the findings are interesting. Findings say that a large number of people who come to Christianity and fall away do it because they are not able to understand the Christian concept of forgiveness, where you say, forgive your enemy, care for your enemy, love your enemy, forgive those who hurt you, don't repay evil for evil, forgive them, and things like that. So this is very, very, this is very difficult. This is very difficult doctrine to understand. And then what people say is, look, I can't be a hypocrite. I can't forgive somebody who has abused me sexually. But I can't forgive somebody who has, who killed my son or a daughter. Or I can't forgive somebody who spoiled my life. I can't somebody who took away all about me without, not being qualified to do this. This is the knife that each one of us carry with us. Can you identify the knife in your life? Can you really say that you don't carry this knife with you? I suspect not. All of us carry this knife, the things that we want to stab others with. Right? For so many things that has been done to us, so many wrong things that has been done to us. Our parents, for example, I want to stab them sometimes for things that have done to me or said to me in the past. Right? So, but no, the problem is, you see this knife, it's not just free. There are some chains attached to it. Do you see these chains? So the feelings that we have for others is like this. They are not independent. There is something attached to the other end of this. So let's see what is at the other end. Do you see this? Can I ask you to come and hold this for them so that they can see? Right? So what is this one? This is the knife Francis holds for me. Right? For things that I have done to him. This is the knife that Sam will hold for me. This is the knife that Leslie will hold for me. She'll of course have a bigger knife. Right? So this is something. So if we have this with us, we have a connection with the other person who holds the same grudge or similar grudge against us. Jonathan, can you come over here please? And we see another chain here. What is that connected with? What do you think this is? It is a snake. What does snake represent here? Genesis. What was snake in Genesis? It is the devil. Right? It is Satan. Then as long as we hold a grudge against others, we are connected with others' grudges against us through this one and through the other route. Now, you're not Satan, by the way. On the other side, the Satan is controlling us through this chain too, because I am holding this. Right? I'm holding this. Now, how do we generally deal with these things? Just stay on for 2 more minutes, okay? Don't do anything with that. How do we generally deal with it? Sometimes what we do is we have this grudge, we hold this knife, we have grudges against people, and what we try doing is we start dealing it by either by ignoring it, or by suppressing it, or by chewing over it, or by trying to bury it, or by taking it out on somebody else by blowing our top. Right? Either yourself or your loved ones or somebody who hurt you or maybe the innocent others also sometimes. Right? We start blowing our top against somebody else. So these are our standard, typical, worldly ways of dealing with this. But they don't deal anywhere. They don't lead us anywhere because they ultimately come back. Any other way that we try to deal with it is, they try to come back. So what is the best way to deal with this? What is the best way to let release us from this prison is very simply let go of what you are holding. Right? Now Francis may still hold from the hold of other people's grudges, and you're forgiving somebody not because they want it, not because they deserve it, but because you deserve it. Because it is for you, it is for your release that we got to release ourselves. It is for our good that we forgive others and let go of others. Let go of the grudges that we hold against others. So that's basically the first thing, you know, to be able to let go, to be able to release ourselves from these bondages that hold us back, is what will distinguish a leader from others. I might have told this before. Do you know, in the villages they have a way of catching monkeys. Do you know this story? Yes? They make a small hole in the coconut, a hole small enough for the monkey's hand to go in, and then they put nuts inside it. And monkeys are curious beings, you know, so they will come and shake the coconut and they will find that it is making noise. So they will curiously put their hand inside it, and once they find the nuts, they're very happy. They grab the nuts. When they grab the nuts, their fist becomes like this, and then it will never come out of the hole. But monkeys are monkeys. They will never let go of the nuts. They will never let go of the nuts. And because of that, what happens is that coconut remains in their hand, and that hampers their movement, and then they get caught. Of course, smarter people will attach another rope to the coconut so that it is easier to catch them. But it happens because the monkeys fail to release or are adamant not to release what they have got in their hands. I'm sure this is Lent season, and that's why it is important for us to remember this. We will soon be, you know, looking at the seven verses, and the first verse that Jesus said, we all of us know this very well. And all of, you know, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they did. All of us say our Lord's Prayer very regularly, where we say, Father, forgive us for our sins and for those who have trespassed against us, for those who sinned against us. How much do we really practice it is the question that we need to ask ourselves during this, during this Lent season. So that's the first thing that we should learn to do, to let go. And the second is, again, a very simple thing. Simple thing. It is to accept the grace that has been poured on us through Jesus' blood. It is to accept that grace. And this is where, people who do not know Christ, right? There are a lot of people who do not know Christ fully. So people who do not know Christ have to depend on pure science or psychology or group therapy or medicines, etc., for this release, right? But people who know Jesus Christ, it's different. It is different because they can go to Jesus Christ and receive God's grace completely through Jesus Christ. And that's the biggest difference. We have the right to claim the salvation, the deliverance, the forgiveness that has already been paid for multiple times. The price has already been paid. But we have to be able to receive it. Last week, I think it must have been in the Daily Bread, where we were reading about a story of a man who was convicted for murder, who was convicted for hanging. So he was about to be hanged. And you know the process of presidential pardon. So, you know, a president can pardon the death sentence of a particular person. So somebody took up this cause, and the president granted the pardon. But surprisingly, the person refused to accept the pardon. And then the case went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court finally ruled that, yes, sorry, even if the president granted the pardon, if the person is not willing to accept the pardon, it is not valid. The pardon is not valid. And so he had to go to the gallows. Now, none of us may willingly refuse grace, or none of us may willingly say that, look, I don't need grace, I don't want salvation. No, none of us would do that. But then the question is, do we live as if we believe that, you know, do we live as if we refrain from claiming it? Do we believe the funny thing about salvation is, we keep saying this, and Bibles keep saying this, there is nothing that you can do to get it. There is nothing that you can do to get it. So if I can't do anything to get it, is it cheap? Is the question that we keep asking. I haven't tried it out anyone, so I don't know whether it will succeed or not. Yeah, so what can go wrong? Nothing, right? So he said, go ahead, try it. So the doctor tried this procedure, and he sent him home saying that, okay, let us observe for a month, and after a month you come back to see what is the status. So the elderly man went back, and after a month He came back. The doctor asked him, "How are you? How is your hearing?" The man said, "Perfect. I can hear everything." And so the doctor said, "Oh, your family must be very happy then, isn't it? They must be rejoicing." He said, "Hold on. I haven't told my family yet. I'm quietly listening to all that they are telling about me. And I have changed my will 4 times in the past 1 month." Do you get the point about the will here? The will that he made a month back, was it of any use to the benevolent or to the person to whom the will was written? Let's say it was me, right? He had written a will to me 1 month back. And it was there. But then could I have taken the benefit of that will? When does that will become effective? The will becomes effective only when the person who wrote that will dies. That's the earthly law. The will becomes effective only when the person who wrote the will dies. Let's go to Hebrews, the book of Hebrews. We haven't opened the Bible yet. I'm almost at the end of my sermon, but let us at least correct it now. Let's open the Bibles. Let's go to the book of Hebrews. The book of Hebrews. Chapter 9, 16 and 17. Verse 16 and 17. Hebrews 9, 16 and 17. Can someone read it, please? If you have an NIV, read it from the NIV.
In the case of testament, there must also of necessity be the death of the testator. For testament is in force after men are dead, since it has no power at all for the testator.
Right. How did the NIV say?
In the case of a will, it is necessary to prove the death of the one who made it. Because a will is in force only when somebody has died.
So the will is in force only when somebody dies, or when the person who wrote the will dies. And so our God knew that for him to release his full grace on his creation, on the people on earth, on us, he had to meet that condition of the will. He had written his will. He had written everything that he has. His wealth, his grace, everything. The mansion that he has there, you know, the buffet, the banquet that we can enjoy there, the eternal life that we can enjoy.